Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote to your exact needs, saving you money on your annual bike, moped or scooter insurance.
Well, don't forget to please press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from so that you never miss an episode. Or you can watch the whole show on YouTube right now for those of you who like pictures as well as sound.
Right. They said it would never last. They said it would be a one-off, but we are back. I can't believe this, Prutz. We're starting series two, and what a guest we've got for you today.
Spot on, Ewan, because we're launching the difficult second album with a lady who lives and breathes bikes and has two stroke running through her veins. She's a TV presenter, a radio presenter, a podcast host, a motoring journalist, and the first lady of MotoGP is, of course, Susie Perry. Hello, Susie.
Hello. Oh, thanks. That's such a nice intro. Thank you.
Well, thank you. All by my fair hand. It's wonderful to have you on. Such an honour. And I think Ewan will agree the best way to kick off the second series, isn't it, mate?
And you forgot to say what a wonderful person as well. I've known Susie for absolutely ever. And every time I've worked with you or seen you socially, you are absolutely delightful. So honestly, this is the best guest we could have booked for our first show of series two. Thank you so much. You are the goddess, of course, of MotoGP. I've got to say, you've done so many jobs through television and in your life. This must be the one, though. This must be the dream job.
What, being on your podcast?
No, it's not a part of that. Well played.
I'm the worst podcast guest ever, by the way. Thanks for the amazing build-up. It's the one job that has weaved throughout my career, I think. I did opt out for a couple of years at the back end of 2009, when I was trying to concentrate on having a family, really, and I had the Gadget Show going on full force. So BBC offered me a contract that I could refuse at the time, I seem to remember. So I thought, do you know what? Let's just do a bit less. So I did. And I cried, I think, every single race for the first year when I watched it because I missed it so much. So it's become part, as in the same way that Wolves is in my DNA, it's in my blood, and being a football fan, I think bikes, you know, has become so by nurture rather than nature. So it's a different thing because I didn't grow up with bikes in my family. It wasn't my dad used to ride sports bikes, or my dad did used to have a BSA, but obviously that was, you know, pre-me. And my brother had a bike for a few years. But my love came sort of further into my 20s, really, when I started to go and watch British Superbikes and World Superbikes with a bunch of friends. And I had a boyfriend who was massively into bikes, and he became my first husband. And it was him really that kind of gave me the love that I really have, and that's a long time ago now. But yeah, I still feel so excited when I'm watching a bike race, and I still jump and flinch and scream at the TV in the same way that I used to nearly 30 years ago. So the love is very real, and what you see is what you get, really.
The great thing with that, Susie, it's and the way that you talk about it, it's something that can't be faked, can it? You can't pretend to like bikes. And the glory of us having this podcast and speaking to people, that main theme is the primal feeling of what grabs you about motorcycles, whether it's watching them, riding them, as you say, it's watching very, very talented people throw them around a track at God knows what speed. And it's you either get it or you don't. That's the gist I think Ewan and I have got from this podcast, is you either get it or you don't, do you?
I think you're right. I think people, you know, people say to me, why isn't MotoGP as big as Formula One? Do you think it could ever be as big as Formula One? And it is in Italy and Spain and lots of other countries, but it's not in our country. It's like it's not in our culture in some way, which is utterly bizarre. But I think you could be right. But I don't think it's been sold properly in our country either. So, you know, I think it's never had the tabloid headlines. It's never got the column inches. And that's always down to the editors. If they like a sport, it's in, you know, because there are sports that punch above their weight that have, I mean, they're not as important now, obviously, newspapers as they used to be. But it used to be you'd have loads of horse racing and sort of more minor sports, but they'd have pages and pages and pages. And the same with Formula One, and MotoGP would get, like, you know, an inch or something like that. If Carl Crutchlow won a race, I mean, it's pretty poor coverage from our sports journalists. I have to call them out on that. I don't think that's been balanced at all over the years. But you kind of get bored of banging that drum, really. And I think if you love it, you love it, you know. And that's who we broadcast to. They're very, sorry, David, but they're just very, our people that watch TNT now, all bikes over the years have an encyclopedic knowledge. So that's why you can't fake standing in front of the camera and talking about bikes, because they really know the sport. And I think there's been people that have been found out over the years that have tried to do that, but that's another story. But yeah, it's an addiction. I think, you know, Ewan will absolutely wholeheartedly agree with this, I'm sure. And talk about passion. I mean, when he was working in MotoGP, that dived out of the screen at you, didn't it, really? But yeah. it is something you get or not. And I think it's just something that fascinates you or it doesn't. And it's as simple as that.
I think it's in your veins, though. Like Pratt said, I think motorbiking and riding bikes, there's something so special about doing it, but also watching it, because you have the utmost respect for the skill level of the riders, whether it's a TT or MotoGP or British Superbikes. But there's something different. Even talking to you, whenever we have any guests on you, you talk about biking and people's faces light up. My face doesn't light up when I talk about, you know, doing a track day in a car or having a nice fast car or a comfortable. But there's something so special about being on two wheels, which... it's like a sisterhood, a brotherhood. It just brings people together. It's so special. What makes it special for you when you are on a bike, as well as watching it, but when you are actually on a bike, what makes it so amazing for you?
It's just me. It's so rare to have that time to yourself, I think. You know, it's that everyone talks about, that sort of feeling of freedom, which it absolutely gives. I have the same when I ride a horse as well. It's the same kind of feeling, although a bike is a bit more predictable than a horse. So, you know, it's that sort of feeling of being at one, you're in the elements, and I don't like some of the elements now, by the way, so I'm not going out on a rainy day. I'm in absolute fair weather. But, yeah, it's that kind of ownership of sitting on an engine and riding it and feeling that freedom and that independence and just having your own thoughts as your company, I think. And it's so rare. It gets even more rare as you get older and you get more responsibilities and you have less time to yourself. So I think it's a beautiful thing, riding a bike. In terms of watching racing, do you know what? I hate it when people slag off any of the riders because I think, you don't know. You don't know what it's like to A, go that fast, probably, certainly over 200 miles an hour, B, be that skillful. So to have opinions, I mean, of course, that's people talk about and that's good. But when they get right, really mean to some of the riders, I just think, I don't know who the hell you think you are. You've got no idea. You know, even, you know, calling a decision. So recently Jorge Martin made the wrong decision and he came in when it wasn't raining enough, and it was a disastrous decision in terms of the championship. And even when, you know, professional riders but at a lower standard were having a go at him, I thought, you don't know either. At that level, you don't know. I mean, the amount of pressure on them is insane. And you know, they're so skillful. And we talk about TT as well, you know, we talk about McGuinness and co. My God, I mean, people go to me, oh, they're mad. They're not mad. They're addicted and they're ultra skillful. And it's so amazing to be able to stand there and watch it and tell the stories. I love it. I'm so lucky to be able to do it. And I've been doing it for nearly 30 years. So, you know, it's, I'm lucky, but I also got the created that job, by the way. So I'm just going to do a little bit of a, you know, I think the, you know, the whole thing about the hard work, lucky you get Gary Player and everything else. But I called up for that job, so I rang Sky.
You went straight into Sky, didn't you? I mean, that's the best way to do it, Susie. This job doesn't exist. I can do this job. Let's see where we go from here. It's an amazing way to do it. It's a great example of, like you say, I love this. It doesn't exist. This is what I'm going to make happen.
Well, you know, it's also being completely green and young and forceful and a bit wild at the time. I suppose I was 26 at the time, 27, something like that. And I got the number. I was at Donington, actually, British Superbikes. And my dad's ex-business partner, Maurice Jones, used to run Donington then. And I was talking to him about it. And he said, do you want to get into World Superbikes? And GP's coming back. Wasn't MotoGP, that was GP. And he gave me the number of a guy called Martin Turner, who is an absolute TV god now. But I rang him and it had his mobile number on the the answer machine and I rang his mobile and I got chatting to him and he went, who are you? I said, I'm nobody. I'm just a bike fan, but I'm just wondering why you don't do this, that and the other. And he went, why don't you come and talk to me and send me a tape of you interviewing? So I did. I was interviewing Jamie Whittam and Neil McKenzie and people like that. I went to see him and he offered me a job as a reporter. It was wild. Honestly, I'll never forget walking out of those offices in Middlesex thinking, I can't believe this. I'm going to be on television. And I thought it was just going for a chat. But he knew, you know, he was pretty smart, really. He knew that there were no girls in the world and this was something different. And it was massively like jumping in with both feet. And it was pretty crazy, the first show, you know, because it was 6 hours live. So
that sense of, and I'm thinking about it from, and Ewan can relate to this as well. So with my recent background of being involved in football broadcasting, which again has changed the kind of dynamic, the landscape of it's changed with obviously wider eyes on the actual game itself, the production, female commentators, presenters, pundits, all that type of stuff. And we've seen different elements of that particular reaction to it. The idiotic end of it, which is a very kind of old school way of looking at how football should look when it's broadcast on telly. And people that have actually got a bit of a brain and kind of go, well, if someone's got something good to say, then that's how you end up on telly. In the environment of superbikes and the motorcycle side of it, Susie, did you encounter any of that? So if you were there trackside, like you say, a couple of decades ago, you've had to take bits of that on the chin. Has it changed at all? Have you've been at the forefront of possibly changing that kind of approach and that quite Neanderthal mentality to when it comes to stuff like that? Have you seen a specific change in that part of the industry?
It's like you can't believe the change, honestly. Mm. So, I mean, you said 2 decades. It's actually nearly 3 decades. Thanks for being kind. I started in 1997. And, yeah, I mean, I had no idea of the ride that I was in for. And I think because I was a bit wide-eyed, I sort of missed a lot of it. And life was very different then as well. So you played or you passed. And you had to learn to deal with everything that was thrown at you. Otherwise, you effectively weren't good enough to be in the arena. So, you know, you didn't report people or you didn't get upset about things. You just boxed it and moved on. But yeah, I mean, when I look back then, I had so many shit things thrown at me. I had I remember a full page in the back of the Daily Mail and the headline was, "They think it's all over. It is now," when I moved from Sky to the BBC. I mean, thanks. So rude. You know, this was written by somebody that had never watched me work on television. And yeah, I was new then and rough around the edges and a bit, you know, a completely different broadcaster to hopefully who I am now. But
well, everyone is at the start.
Of course you are.
You start in one place and hopefully you get better. That's the nature of the business.
And also, I think, Dave, the styles change. You know, it's very much a Sky style. It was quite in your face. It was very much me in vision. Because if you go back to those days, you didn't have the reporter in vision very often. If you're doing an interview, it was over the shoulder. But because it was a girl and because I was in my 20s and looked all right, they put me in vision. That's the truth of it. And it became something completely different. They had not done that before and they hadn't done it on the BBC. So when I moved to the BBC in 2000, there were some in-house complaints about why do we have her in vision so much?
God.
You know, when I was doing a grid walk or walking down the pit lane and it's de rigueur now, everybody does it, but nobody did it then apart from Martin Brundle and me.
In terms of earning your stripes, I know for a fact not only have you gained the respect of the viewers because you've proved you're bloody good at what you do, what was the riders' reactions to you then? If the outside world was a little bit, oh, what's this female doing this, presenting here? Why is she in business so much? You've got a great relationship with the riders. I've seen it through the years. Have they always been good with you or did you also have to gain their trust and prove yourself to them a bit?
I think they were just a bit. Generally, they pretty much liked it to start with. If I look back, 27-year-old girl asking them questions for a change than a, you know, big, hairy old bloke. So they kind of liked that. Sorry, it wasn't aimed at anybody in particular, but you get my point. I then knew I had to ask good questions. And of course, I wanted to ask good questions. I wanted to be there. It was quite sniffy from a lot of the journalists, more than the riders. But I do remember being in a press conference once in Italy, and one of the Italian journalists said to Valentino Rossi, he was really young at the time, I think he was in 250s, and or maybe 125s actually, and they said, what do you think of the new Sky Girl? In a presser. And I'm sitting in the press conference. And honestly, I just sort of slumped down in my chair and I thought, oh my God, this could be horrendous. And he was really sweet about me and said that, you know, it was always really fun talking to me and good interviews. But also Mick Doohan did something really great for me. I don't even know if he ever remembers doing this, but somebody asked him that question. And he said, she asks really great, great questions. And that kind of went round the paddock. And it sort of softened everything for me a little bit. And I became a little bit more part of the furniture. Slowly, slowly, in time, you know, you kind of find your way in. And it's about trust, I think. So, you know, you're operating back then on 15 races a year. Now it's 20. I mean, you've got to ask the hard questions, but you've also got to ask the questions again the following week or two. And you've got to get an interview. So it's a fine line between getting the story and being strong, but also not pissing people off to the point where now they'll be like, oh, we're not going to speak to TNT anymore. You know, because that happens, which is wrong. But it's a really, really a kind of fine glass that you will walk on. But yeah, I mean, I didn't feel like I was really accepted for a few years. But eventually you become a pair of slippers, which is nice.
And the longevity career-wise, Susie, speaks for itself. I mean, just to put it into context of the MotoGP schedule, you talk about having to be in the right place at the right time with the right questions and gauge the mood, I presume, of the riders, because everyone has a good day, everyone has a crap day, everyone kind of, and you've got to work out where the story is, and of course for the people back in your ear that tell you what potentially they want to know for discussion back at base. But so we're recording it in mid-September now, this one. And we're catching up because you are absolutely all over the place, aren't you? Off the run of European races.
Then you're going to head to
Indonesia. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Away from the personal stuff. I mean, this is your professional stuff. Japan, Indonesia, Australia, Thailand, and Malaysia before you're back for race 20 in Valencia in mid-November. I mean, jet setting, it sounds, in quote unquote, people who have a normal job, I mean, that sounds absolutely phenomenal, and it is phenomenal, and we can see your passion for it and the privilege and the honor that you feel doing it. But my word, I mean, are there some days where you sit thinking, right, where am I, what am I doing, and what on earth are we going to be doing next?
You know, sometimes when you get off a plane, you get to passport and they say, oh, which flight were you on or where have you come from? Sometimes I look at them, I'm like, I don't know. I don't know where I've just
come
from.
I've definitely come from somewhere.
I'm going somewhere. Yeah, so right, so there is a dark side to this in that for the first, I'm going to say decade, it fills you with joy to travel to these places and be that person with the bag, and you're living out your bag, and you go into all these different cultures, eating different food, and you don't get any time off when you're there, particularly. On the long hauls that I'm going on now, you'll get one day where you're not traveling or working. So you can actually have a little bit of time to explore or do something. Mm-hmm. And I quite like that still. But actually traveling now after, you know, nearly 30 years is a ball ache, especially since Brexit. Honestly, yeah. It's so difficult because you don't have the amount of flights. So the choices aren't that great. So there's not so many directs. So you're taking more flights. You're having more delays, you know, and it's living with jet lag for, well, I'm going to say about 4 months of the year. And being tired. And it has a physical effect on your body as well, I think, traveling so much. I mean, we've talked about the upsides and they are still overwhelming the downsides, but definitely at this stage, you know, and I always think when we go to Japan, we all sort of slightly lose the plot when we're on air. For some reason, there's a thing there. I don't know whether you have this, Ewan, but you're broadcasting and you get that kind of Snoopy school thing, what in your ears when you get jet lag, you know, and you're like, what? And sometimes I think, I don't know what I'm saying. And I look at the boys and they're looking at me because I have to crack the whip. And I'm like, ugh! You know, that's the one for me. It's the middle of the night here where you really have to focus and draw on absolutely everything. And I have open talk back. I've always have ever since day one, which I think is quite rare these days now, because most people have something called switch. So the difference is...
Open's the best way, Susie. I've always thought. I just really enjoy everyone. If it's quiet, I'm suddenly thinking, oh my God, something happened.
I know, exactly. And you want to know, if you say something that's mildly amusing, was it actually funny or was it just funny in your kooky head? You know, and if the gallery in London is laughing or chuckling, you know, you get a vibe, don't you, for the feel of the programme.
Yeah.
And because I work with such amazing people, and my team that I work with are incredible, Neil and Michael and Sylvain and co, they are fantastic. Gavin's a great commentator. I mean, this is the best team I've worked with in all of my career by a million miles. And we are absolutely like a family, and it's rock solid. And I love to be able to hear what's going on in London. I have director, the PA who does all the characters to the breaks and everything else. And I have a guy, Kevin, who's my editor. I have the programme side, which is always, you know, two guests. And then the odd other person popping up that shouts something in the gallery. So there's quite a lot of voices going on in my head, which you just get used to in time, and you pick out the ones when you need to pick them out, because obviously you've got to hit your counts at zero and everything, especially if you're doing a simulcast, which we've been doing in the last couple of years. So we broadcast to America, New Zealand and the UK on TNT, and then sometimes we'll also broadcast live on ITV. Going down a rabbit hole here, stop me if you're bored. But on ITV, they'll take a break. But I'm not allowed to say, right, we'll take a little break now and we'll see you in a couple of minutes. What I have to do is just stop talking for 2 seconds, let them take the break, and then pick up seamlessly after 2 seconds. And this can happen about 7 or 8 times during the broadcast. And they change channels, and that's a hard count to zero. And you must not miss it. You've got to hit zero with your sentence, and then it's got to seamlessly pick up. And this, I think, is where you earn your money, you know. Yeah. And I love it because it's such a challenge. And when you've been, I think, working for so long, it's sort of de rigueur, and you come on, you do your thing. But when you've got this to do as well, it's something extra, and it stops the flow of sometimes of the conversation that you want to, you know, massively get into. I'm really lucky with our editor, because if something's really good that we're talking about or some's breaking news, he's listening, so he's letting it go longer, and he'll just chuck something out of the show later on. And that for me is the, you know, it's just the best way of working. But when you're jet lagged and this is going on, you know, this just makes it a bit more difficult, getting back to the travel question. So yeah, I'm about to go and do something like 7 races in 8 weeks or 9 weeks, and it's a lot. And it's also, you know, you've got to find loads of stuff to talk about when you've just had a race last weekend as well, which can be limiting sometimes.
Yeah,
but you know, it's all part of the
job.
Yeah, it's part of the, if you can call it a job. I mean, that's what everybody's like, oh, you got the greatest job in the world. And it is, it's amazing.
I was going to say, the best job in the world. You've clearly just illustrated how hard it is as well. But that's the beauty of you as a presenter. I think you make it look easy, but having been involved myself, it made me smile. You were reeling off some names there. You're away from home so much. We've established the travel is a ball ache, and it's hard, the jet lag, hotels, the loneliness. But you are with some great people. You know, just even Gavin and Hodgie would be enough to entertain anyone. But how fortunate do you feel that you're working literally with brothers? They really are great people. It does
help.
That's
a good word. That's the perfect word. They are brothers, and we all lean on each other because we're together so much outside of our families, because we're away for half the year together. I mean, we're actually with each other more than our families, really. And, you know, in all of our lives, as we get older, we've all had things that have gone on personally. And they've been incredible support for me, and hopefully me, them as well, in different issues. And we've all had things that have gone on. And also, you know, Nat Quirk joined us a few years ago, and she's been like a sister to me. And we have a lovely producer called Alana, who's a young girl who came in her mid-20s, and she's like a daughter. It's fantastic. It just gets you through those sort of moments. And they've kept me working, to be completely honest. I don't want to go down too much of a rabbit hole because it's not that sort of podcast, but there's been times where I could have just thrown the towel in, really. Over the last couple of years. And I lost my mom, and I have not handled it at all well. And it's been life-changing. And I've, you know, there's just, it's funny, you put a post out on Instagram, everyone's like, oh, you look so happy, I love your smile, da 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 da. And, you know, you're in a hotel room crying your eyes out at night sliding down a wall. Not all the time, but these are the differences in your day, you know, and your emotions and your feelings. And those guys have absolutely kept me together. So, yeah, really important, really, really important.
What you just said then, obviously we won't go down into all people's personal issues and stuff, but it is almost like Insta versus reality, isn't it? You have to be on 100%. Screen. You have to be this big, entertaining, bubbly, knowledgeable person. But yeah, actually, at night, you're yourself. And you, that can be really tough in any industry, but especially when you're in the public eye, you have this persona where you have to be that jolly person all the time, even though inside you might not be feeling it. So credit to yourself and, you know, the lovely people you work with, because it does make a difference. I have to work with Pruss. That's enough for me to want to quit every series. But yeah.
You can, I see, mean, when he glazes over, he's gone into autopilot mode and he's not listening to me.
You know, it's, I just sometimes feel a bit guilty of only putting out one side, and then I think, well, but I'm quite private. And but you know, when I lost my mom, I had so many people say, oh, you know, how are you dealing with the grief? And so I did do a couple of posts, because I just think sometimes if you see somebody that you feel like, you know, that's able to get up in the morning and go to work, it does help a little bit. And if it did, that's why I wanted to sort of do that. But yeah, it's difficult, and I'd like to spend a bit more time with my dad now, you know, so being away from him, I find that very difficult as well.
Which certainly, I think, and again, going off what Ewan said, Susie, it's certainly something that you put out with honesty, because as we said, there's a lot of stuff on there which is whitewashed and made to look a certain way, but I think it just adds to the appeal. Like you say, the longevity of what you've done in the job, and being able to show the other side of it, which, yes, glamour, travel, jet setting, etc., but it's fundamentally something that gets you to nice places, that pays the bills, that you're very, very good at. So I think it's absolutely right that you're able to show both sides of it. And given what sports bike fans are like, and having grown up with you, there'll be a real kind of empathy, I think, and a sympathy to the way that you've gone about that.
Well, I hope so, but thank you. I mean, you know, my mum always wanted me to, when she was not very well, she said, I want you to go to work. I want you to go, because she loved watching it. She watched every single second of everything I did, and she loved the bikes. So I went, and still, you know, now I think the most important thing to me still is storytelling, getting out there and being able to tell those stories. And the privilege to do so is overwhelming. So, yeah, it's still a lot of fun.
Well, I'll tell you what, let me do a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping, because I'm the grown-up in all this. If you haven't already, please press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from, so you never miss an episode, or you can keep watching the show on YouTube. I meant grown-up between me and you and Susie, yeah, of course, not bracketing right. You in that, of course.
Pruss, everyone's a grown-up. My six-month-old baby's more mature than me, so yeah. We know that.
He's a busy man, is the boy, Thomas. Yeah, exactly. Let's get into the specifics then of motorcycles and riding motorcycles and ownership of motorcycles. What's your ownership journey thus far, Susie?
Not that scintillating, as you would imagine. Probably that's why you're asking me this question. But yeah, so I went and did my test in my mid-20s, and I rode a Honda CB500 to pass my test on, and I called my mum afterwards and she cried because she didn't know I was going to do my test. So she wasn't particularly happy about that. And then my first bike was a Ducati Monster, which was stupid, really, because that's a beautiful bike, but the worst first bike you could have had back in those days, because, you know, it had the turning circle of a double-decker bus. I'm going back to the 90s. It's not like that now, but it was then. So that was a bit tough. And then I kind of went through a stage of having Hondas, so 600s, for a few years, and then I sort of stopped riding on the road in London, because I just found it
terrifying, frustrating.
Terrifying, frustrating. I always had gear to carry, so I would end up driving, and I at the time I had an S2000, which is kind of like a motorbike on four wheels, as close as you can get. So I loved that car, so I used to, you know, drive that car more than I was riding. And then your bike would get nicked from the front of your house, or you'd ride, someone would try and ride you off the road, and then they'd apologise because they saw you were a girl, and that would be worse than them riding you off the road, you know. And I'd be like, do you know what, I'm a bit done with this. So so I didn't ride so much then. And then I spent time in France, and I had a Triumph Bonneville. So I changed from sports bikes to a bit more of a comfortable sit-up bike, and admitted that I was getting older, which is fine. And so, yeah, so that I wrote for different magazines back in the day and tested, you know, bikes and things. So that was also a bit of fun. But I don't ride very much anymore, really, which is probably a bit sad, really. And I probably need to get back into it, but I don't have the time.
I was going to say, is it time? Is it time of life? Is it a bit of both, really?
It's a time thing, and I'm kind of not really probably around people that ride that much anymore. So it's, you know, it would be making an effort to go and ride now. But I would like to do more than I do. And also, the last time I rode, I broke my leg.
Jesus.
I know. Well, the thing, I was doing an off-road thing and the weather was horrendous. I didn't fall off my bike or anything. It was the most innocuous rubbish. Put my foot down and it slipped on the mud and it just snapped my leg. So that's an age thing. There you go.
Well, I mean, that sense of, because it's just immediately jogged my mind back to, I was away in the summer on my bike and I'd gone back via Hull to see my parents and I pulled up next to where they live on this to fill it up with petrol, and miles away, having ridden for 3 or 4 days straight, just went to put the bike seemingly on the side stand that I'd forgotten to put down. So as you lean over, and this is a Bonneville Bobber, so it's quite a heavy bike but quite low, as it starts to go down, obviously you put your foot out, and then I just proceeded to do a middle-aged man middle splits as it just kind of went. My leg went out. Oh. I got it. And in my head, I'm screaming all the swear words under the sun. I managed to kind of ragdoll it back up, put it on the stand, fill it up. And I went in and the girl, I said, number whatever. She went, all right. She said, are you okay? I said, you saw that, didn't you? She started giggling. She said, yes, I did. And then I went, did I style it out? And she went, no, you didn't. But go careful. And then wandered off like tail. You think you look like a dead cool biker who nearly laid his bike down on a petrol station.
It's always the slow ones, isn't it? And the small ones.
Terrifying. But I think that was a kind of going back to ex-athlete days. You go, oh, I don't think my groin felt like that before. Before I put the bike down, you went limping off. But I can totally see. But I suppose if the last time you did that, you broke your leg, then I can see why there might be a little bit of apprehension, especially if you're going to go off-roading again.
Yeah, well, maybe not. I mean, the funny thing was, it was during sort of when we were slightly coming out of COVID and we were still broadcasting our show from the VT Tower in London. I mean, that's a whole other podcast, all of that, because I had to live in a hotel in London. Because I couldn't go backwards and forwards. So I lived in a hotel for 3 months. It was a bit like The Shining, actually, sometimes. It was only me and the whole hotel during the week. And then the team would turn up at the weekend and we'd film our show from the VT Tower. And this happened the day before we were filming. And I kind of hobbled in with my boot on and everything, with my crutches, and they just all laughed. All of them just laughed. I thought it was absolutely hilarious. I got zero sympathy at all from any of them. And I had to hobble around there for up and down that blooming tower while we were broadcasting and put my leg up and stuff like that. But that's what you get from bikers. But they did give me some good tips on fixing it. So fair play for them.
Fair play. I think your selection of bikes is pretty good. But in terms of riders, I know this is going to be a very difficult question. I know you've got great relationships with riders, but who is the one superstar of the sport that you love seeing week in, week out, or someone who you've interviewed in the past? Who's been your favourite rider? I think I know the answer, but who's been your favourite? There's got to be one man in MotoGP, surely. The big man, Valentino, he's got to be the superstar. Is he not? There was just such a charisma about him. There's such an aura. In my mind, he is the ultimate sportsman. I loved him.
Oh, sorry, I'm making you wait. Of course it's bloody Valentino. Yeah. I mean, my career went alongside his time in the paddock. And that's been my absolute joy, really, to build up this professional relationship with him. And I remember the first time I interviewed him was in Mugello in the pit lane. And I had Loris Caparossi on one side and Valentino on the other side. And I'm sure everybody knows the difference in height. So we look like a little trio. And Valentino, this is going back to 1998, didn't speak very much English in those days. But he had obviously this incredible charisma already. And this sort of party boy, circus, bringing the show and doing it out on track, you know, winning as well. He would become world champion. He was already world champion in 97 in 125s. So I asked Loris this question, something like, you know, being at home in Mugello, blah, 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 blah. Loris answers it and he's brilliant as always. And I looked at Valentino and I asked him a different question. And he looked at me and he sort of screwed his face up and he went, I want the same question as Loris. Because he'd worked his answer out, you know, for that one. So I had to repeat the question to Valentina. That was the first interview I did with him. And he didn't stop making me laugh for the following, you know, 25 years or whatever it was. And we had a lot of incredible interviews where he had this gift that he would make you feel like you were the only person in the whole world. And he was telling you something really special. And he would listen to you and he would cock his head on one side and listen to what you were saying and process it and give you an answer. Now, I think what people don't know about Valentino, well, maybe they do, but he's really smart. I mean, he's built himself this incredible business empire. I mean, he's loaded. not for that, but, you know, he employs lots of people and he knows what he's doing and he always has. Secondly, he's ruthless as a rider on track, you know, and off track, I think, with business as well. So he's super, super, super smart. He knew exactly the landscape when he was talking to you and he knew exactly what he was doing. But yeah, we, you know, we had a lot of laughs over the years and we've done some amazing things, actually, when I think about it. I've ridden Pillion with Valentino around London on a Honda Goldwing, which was
no way. A
one-off, you know, no one else I know has ridden Pillion with Valentino. So that was really fun. I was asked
What's he like on a Goldwing as opposed to a superbike? Does he take it easy or?
It was kind of weird for both of us, I suppose. Like, it was like riding around on a sofa. I was filming stuff for the BBC, you know, I'd got these GoPros and chatting to him as we were riding around, and he was looking at the sights. We went past Buckingham Palace, so we've been sightseeing together on the Goldwing, which was really great, part of this big press thing that happened. I think it was 2004 in London. And then I got asked by Lord March to go to Goodwood when they finally managed to get Valentino to come, because every year they would ask him. He's always too busy and he never went there. But it was a Yamaha anniversary, so he went for that. And he rode round the grounds and he rode the bike into the house and then came upstairs and I was on the balcony and introduced him. He just won in Assen the day before. I mean, it was honestly, it's like perfect. Talk about the stars aligning. And I did this big build up and I wasn't quite sure when he was going to come in, you know, so I had to keep on going and milking the crowd. You couldn't see a blade of grass. I mean, you couldn't see. They said at the time they'd never had that amount of people waiting for a guest at the house. And so the weather was beautiful. I ended up doing this. It got so big, this intro, that when he walked on, I was almost in a back bend with my microphone and not announcing him. And he walked on and he was just laughing at me. And when it was great and he stood there and he sort of got his arm draped over me really casually. I think that sort of shows the trust in each other and our relationship over the years, maybe. You know, so it's been a joyous ride to be able to work alongside Valentino. And Even our last interview that we did with him was supposed to be 20 minutes and he gave us 45 minutes because we did something a bit special with him, put all different names on the walls and we talked about different eras and different experiences. And he loved that because it was something different and a bit challenging, you know, and we had a real laugh doing that to the point where we had so much content. Because his PR guy was trying to pull him away. He's like, no, it's okay. And we got so much content that we turned it into a documentary and we went to Tavulia just to pad it out a bit. But we told the story from that interview at Silverstone, which is kind of a fitting end, I think, really, to, you know, what has been, as Ewan says, you know, I've been really lucky to imagine, you know, having like James Hunt or George Best or Muhammad Ali, if you were boxing, person as your go-to interview for year after year after year after year. That's been my experience. And yeah, it's been fantastic to really be the storyteller of the man who put MotoGP on the map and the man that has made it what it is today.
That sense of development, of history, of a passion that you dedicated your professional life to, Susie, and these huge figures, they come and go, such as the life cycle of an athlete. And the one constant, it seems, still, and it goes back to the longevity discussion earlier on, is you're the kind of North Star for all these people moving around in this particular sphere, in this particular profession. What are the highlights for you, if you can tell us, because it sounds like you've had so many, and then off the back of that, what does the future hold? Do you keep steaming on until told otherwise? Is that how it works?
I don't know how it works. I think, you know, I mean, I've got a very good relationship with Marc Marquez as well, but it's over time. You know, I've done things, corporate events with him, I've sat with him for, you know, periods of time, and I I think it's different to Valentina, but it's also the same. There's a trust, there's an inherent trust. And, you know, you feel like you can ask the sort of deeper questions and get a better answer and that kind of thing. There's a new breed, obviously, now coming through. You've got the legacy of Valentino in the Pekka Vanjaer and Marco Bezzecchi and co. And you've got Jorge Martin. And these are riders that I don't know them. I don't have the same relationship. But also, I'm not a reporter anymore. So I don't have that week in, week out of grabbing the interviews with them. I'm the anchor now, so I'm slightly removed from being able to have that kind of intimate time with them. And when I say intimate, it's purely professional, because I know over the years people will go about me and Valentino. There must have something been going on there, like, oh my God, you know. You don't ask that to guys ever. It's just ridiculous. And no, you know, we were friends and not even great friends. You know, I don't have Valentino's phone number. I'm not a close friend of him, but in terms of a working relationship, it very much was that. I don't feel the need to be their friends. I'm not their friend. I'm there to ask questions.
And you can have rapport and chemistry. Yes. You quite obviously did Valentino without it having to be.
Don't you think that's
else,
different, yeah. Dave? That's a different thing. And yeah. I think it's really confused at the moment, and I don't like to see it really. Maybe I'm just old fashioned. But, you know, I see reporters now saying things and hugging the riders, and I just think, oh, you know, and then they've got on their bio journalist broadcaster. No, you know, you're crossing the two worlds there. And yeah. I don't think that's very professional, but maybe that's just me being old. In terms of the future, I honestly, I don't know. I mean, at the moment, honestly speaking, my job ends at the end of the season. So, you know, I don't know what the future brings. And as a broadcaster, as a self-employed broadcaster, slash employed if you're the tax man, because they think that we're all employed now. Just get that out of the way.
Yeah.
You don't know.
And sometimes the big examples of that that people read about, they just presume that everyone's in the same boat, and you go, no. That's one person at a big place that does that. It's not the same thing for everyone else, isn't it? It's assuming all footballers are on £100,000 a week when it's not quite the case.
No, really, really, really not. But, you know, that aside, I don't know what the future holds. What I do know is that I want to carry on telling stories, and it would be nice to go again in MotoGP. But if that's not the case, I'm a big music lover, you know, and I'm good friends with Bob Harris, and we've got some ideas of things we'd like to do together. We've also got the Gadget Show.
Must be a Zeppelin fan then, Sue. Who's been a Wolves fan as well? Come on.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's our walk-on tune.
Just needed to get that sorted.
You know, the weird thing is sometimes I'm sitting there and Robert Plant sits often in front of where I am. And then, you know, they play Kashmir and the guys walk out. And I look at Robert and I think, what are you thinking now? You know, it's so weird. It's like, this is one of the greatest songs in the world. And obviously, they were the biggest band in the planet back in the day. My dad knows Robert Plant from the sort of music. So my dad was a music promoter and agent and everything. And so that's sort of part of me as well. And I also, you know, have just reignited my relationship with the Gadget Show, which I think is why I was supposed to talk about this before, but we've got the Gadget Show podcast is back. Ewan's been a guest on that with me. I remember doing some running thing, didn't we? We were running around a park doing something together once.
We've done all sorts. That was for smartwatches. Do you remember the one where you stitched me up and there was hidden cameras and Jason was in fancy dress in a restaurant and you kept me waiting to film and film and film? Do you remember? It was in Soho somewhere, and it was a spoof restaurant with a robot waiter. Yeah. And all I remember was you kept me waiting like 5 hours. I was being all, it's all right, don't worry about it. Oh, they're just setting up. And I can't remember exactly what the premise was, but it was like a hidden camera show. There was hidden cameras everywhere. But anyway, that was, it's always fun.
Well, I did that show for 16 series over 8 years. We did all the live shows at the NEC. It was a fantastic time. And I left at the end of 2011. When I got a phone call early this year to say, do you realise it's been 20 years since the Gadget Show started in 2004? We want to do a podcast with you and Jace and bring back some of the OG, you know, bring back John and Otis as guests, which we duly did. So we're also going for our second series as well soon. So, you know, that's going on, which is great fun. And I think that USP maybe is the fact that we have fun on it, because you see all these incredible tech videos now on YouTube and they're so slick. I mean, all these content creators are amazing, but quite boring really to watch. It's great for your facts, but you don't have a laugh, do you? You know, it's just straightforward. So we have a bit of a laugh doing our pod. So it's, you know, I never know what the future holds. And in the past, it's always been the exciting thing really, because when you land something new, when you're self-employed, it gives you a lifeline, doesn't it? It gives you a massive big buzz. But there's that sort of threat of, oh, I might not have any work by the end of the year. And I've been in that situation. You know, I've been in that situation with the end of the Gadget Show. I had nothing after that. Also, Formula One, day before Christmas, told me that they were giving the contract away and I had nothing. It's the ups and downs, isn't it?
Yeah. I've got a funny feeling, Susie, whatever the future holds, you're going to absolutely smash it and love it. But listen, before you go, we always will ask this one last question. Picture this. You're in your dream location, riding your dream bike, listening to your favourite music. So where are you riding? What bike are you on? Are you with anyone or you can be on your own? And what are you listening to? Tell us what that would be.
Okay, right. Let me tell you, can I tell you what bike first?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could go down the sports bike and go, oh, Carl Fogarty's 916, because obviously that was a call, but it's not going to be comfortable to do this ride. So I'm going to pick, and I like retro bikes, so I'm going to go with a bike that I love, and I've sort of stood next to it and spent quite a long time staring at it when we were filming at Triumph during COVID. So that's Steve McQueen's TR6, obviously the great escape bike. Nice. You know, not when it looks like a BMW, obviously, in the film, it had to be a German bike. So the original TR6, so the 1961 trophy, I'd be that bike in your British racing green. I think I'd quite like to be with my mates, actually, from MotoGP. So all the gang from MotoGP. And I know they're all fans of where I'd like to ride as well. So this is all going to work. There might not be my music. But Cape Town, South Africa. So South Africa is one of my favourite countries. Yep. I hope no one's done this one. I have listened to a few of your pods, but I haven't heard anybody do this one. So starting somewhere like either at the harbour or Sea Point, and then riding the beach road. So you go past Clifton Beach to Camps Bay, stop for a coffee in Camps Bay, have some breakfast, watch the world go by. I mean, it's so beautiful there. And this ride, right, it's you're right next to the sea. You've got this incredibly rugged sheer cliffs that drop down, and it's kind of an arrogant kind of environment, and it's wild, and you've got the Atlantic on the right hand side as you drive, and the sun's obviously shining, right? It's a bit breezy and there's probably some sharks in the Atlantic, but we'll move on. So you go past, you might see some whales migrating if you're there at the right time of the year. I've been there and seen that. That's absolutely phenomenal. You go past the 12 Apostles, ride past there, past Llandudno Beach, and then on to Hout Bay. Hout Bay is a lovely place. I've stayed there a few times and they've got this incredible market. I know not everybody will have stopped on their bike journey, but I have to keep stopping for things because I like to make it a whole big travel log. Then I would kind of go take a little bit of a tangent here and go through Chapman's Peak, which isn't always available, but it's really beautiful and it's quite frightening in a way. But it's makes you feel like you're in a movie, I think, when you drive or ride through there. So I go through Chapman's Peak and then just stop off at Nordhook Beach. And Nordhook Beach is white sand. It's vast. And they have these ex-race horses there. So park your bike, jump on a racehorse, ride down the beach, watch out for your personal stuff. You've got to put all that somewhere safe. Then go to a place called Monkey Valley there and have the seafood platter. And you look straight over through this white pristine sand to the beach, which is absolutely incredible. After that, then you take a ride down to Cape of Good Hope, actually. Let me just stick my glasses on. So, yeah, so if you go down all the way down to the Cape, you've got where the Atlantic meets the Indian Ocean. And it's so wild down there. You know, you stand there and you feel like you're at the end of the world. And it's fantastic, the route. You know, it looks beautiful. You've got all the nature. You might see some baboons. You've got the Finbos and all the incredible floral kingdom down there. So it's absolutely spectacular. Then come back and go to Simonstown, and I would end up at Boulders Beach, Boulders Bay. I don't know if you've been there. I haven't been there for a decade now, but you used to be able to swim with the African penguins that have got a colony. I'm sure they're probably more protected. Who's got a cat?
No, sorry. I was going to say, I think my baby boy Bowie is in agreement with your journey. He's trying to talk in the background. Sorry. Your music could be David Bowie. What's your music then, Susie? What was your playlist? What's your favourite song?
I've got a good David Bowie story about my dad, but we probably haven't got time for that. It depends on the day, really, in terms of genres. I love rock music. I love modern country music, but I've gone with my yacht rock and my love of yacht rock, because that is my kind of go-to if I'm not in a particular mood. So things like Steely Dan, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Michael McDonald, nice. Climax Blues Band, bit of Supertramp, bit of the Eagles, Billy Joel, Fleetwood Mac. I mean, I can make you a mixtape, but all that stuff, I can't hear it too many times. So I'd be having that blasting out. So that
sounds
would be
like a,
joyous.
Sounds like a dream.
Do you want to come?
I love it.
I think it's safe to say we'd both be there with bells. And do you know what, Ewan, and I'm sure you're thinking the same thing. You know when you get a proper journo on, someone who's really intelligent and knows exactly what she wants to say and actually does her homework for the dream ride? That is amazing.
You were going through every single beach, every single stop off. Normally we get people saying, oh, yeah, I'd go up the 316 or whatever it might be. But yeah, love the fact that you put so much effort into that. And yeah, it sounds like a dream ride. And that bike as well. Oh, lovely. Yeah.
And everywhere you stop, people would be walking up and looking at it. Because if you've got a retro bike, generally, you know, people come over, don't they? And they want to ask you about the bike. And it's nice to have those conversations. And, you know, it's that thing that you started this podcast is by saying how uniting it is. If you like bikes, like sport and like music, these are the things that, you know, unite us. It doesn't matter where you're from, what your walk of life you're from. You're just talking about an engine there or a fairing or whatever it is. And yeah, loads and loads of fun. So that would be my dream ride.
Susie, I've loved your passion today. Your beaming smile, it's really nice to, it's just a pleasure to have you on and see you in a happy place talking about things you clearly love. And it's been mega. I've loved it.
Oh, well, thank you. I don't really like doing podcasts because I don't really like talking about myself.
Thankfully, you told us at the end.
But I always say no, actually, because I just feel quite uncomfortable. I prefer to be asking the questions, you know, like you guys. But thank you for making me feel so comfortable. And I mean, it's Ewan. Obviously, Ewan's like a brother anyway. So, lovely to meet you, David. Thank you so much.
And you.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks.
I can see Ewan as the brother. You know what I mean?
The boundless.
You said it, mate. I mean, sadly, of course, that's about it for this week's Full Chat, powered by Bikeshaw, the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker. Bikeshaw will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance and much, much more.
A huge thank you to, honestly, I think the most popular guest we're ever going to have on here. The one and only amazing... No, clearly, 100%. The one and only Susie Perry. Thank you, Susie.
Thank you so much. Lots of love to you all.
Amazing. Don't forget to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from so you never miss an episode. You can watch it all on YouTube, hopefully like you've just done.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening or watching, and we will see you next time.